courtesy of the Finance Committee, we've had our safety briefing. We won't repeat that. Are there any questions with respect to the agenda? Hearing none, can we have a motion to approve the agenda?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And with respect to the minutes for the prior meeting, any amendments to those minutes? If not, could I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. We have three items on the agenda this morning. Jim Doherty and Dr. Hirsch from the Institute of Behavior Resources will be briefing us on the state of play with respect to our fatigue risk management system. Pretty sophisticated analysis that I look forward to hearing. We will get a briefing from Chief Human Resources Officer Tanya Moore McGee. We'll introduce a member of the Hay Group who supervised the employee engagement survey, which is actually a broader set of issues than simply safety and security, but has some very interesting findings in that regard that really relate to what we found for our employees 2 years ago, and I think it's a measure of where we've come from there. We're going to open the meeting with the TOC, Jim Benton, who will provide the quarterly report from the Tri-State Oversight Committee. We'll have time to discuss that. We appreciate the continued relationship with the TOC. But just before we begin, I wanted to recognize a couple of things that have happened since the last time we met. It will be reflected in Mr. Doherty's safety review when we get that, probably in February, for the full year. Two additional National Transportation Safety Board recommendations have been closed out in the last month, so we're continuing to make progress on that. Several others are pending before the board, but I know from discussions with the board chair and with other members, they are very pleased with the progress that we're making, and we'll continue to work on that. We also want to note that the TOC has adopted five of our recent incident investigation reports. Those, again, are a key part of our safety environment, that we look at incidents that have happened, analyze them, report, and we're catching up on that. And then lastly, within the last week, you have seen the FTA audit that was done at the request of the congressional delegation. It's, I think, on the whole, a pretty good audit, pretty good findings. It stresses, again, our improvement is there, but it's fragile if we don't keep keep progress on. And I've asked staff to put on the January meeting of this committee a review of the FTA audit and where we should take that. And if you read it between now and then, it's a good indication of where we need to put our time. But let me turn it over to Mr. Benton with respect to the TOC report.
Thank you, Mr. Downey. Thank you, board members. I'm here to brief us for our quarterly report. Last time I was here was in September, and it's nice to be back. And as Mr. Downey said, I think there is good news to report with the NTSB closures, as well as the five adoptions of incidents that were submitted on the FTA audit report. Also, they've submitted additional findings for three more in addition to those five that we're currently reviewing. So some of the things that we've been doing is a rule compliance study and TOC mock audit that we've done to try to improve relationships and our procedures and our processes, working with WMATA to keep the safety culture going. The internal safety and security audits remain strong. We are attending those and invited to those to witness those as they're being taken place. And they're an important part of the safety culture here. CAP progress, as was mentioned, remains strong. And the internal safety audit CAPs are especially strong. One of the things in the FTA audit report was to improve our CAP spreadsheet, which we're currently working with the FTA to and WMATA to improve. Some of the other things we're doing is the TOC Silver Line and 7,000 series cars projects. We have a TOC executive meeting next week out at the Dulles Transit Partners office, and we're going to take a tour of the Dulles extension says that'll be nice to get the Secretaries of Transportation and the Associate Director out to visit. We do have a three-year review, triennial, due in 2013, which we'll talk about here in a little bit. Some of the proactive...
Just got to ask, the triennial is FTA's review of how you were doing.
It's the FTA requirement to review the transit agency, and the State Safety Oversight will perform that review. Okay. Some of the proactive safety programs that WMATA has here is the safety measurement system and compliance with the notification and reporting requirements outlined as minimum requirements in the 49 CFR Part 659. And our program standard goes above that, and we'll talk about that as well. And we would like to thank the Safety Department for participating in our mock audit and supplying resources to us to accomplish that. So thank you, Jim. Some of the incidents and hazards, notification requirements, as I say, we work together, and sometimes there's a gray area on the reporting requirements outlined in 49 CFR 659. They're listed as minimum requirements, so we have to do at least this much, and our TOC program standard goes well beyond that, and I hope everybody understands why we do that. But sometimes there's a difference of opinion, and we work together well through that and come to a reasonable solution. And WMATA is always willing to help us in any way they can. next slide. Under the rule compliance study, what was undertaken was we went out and shadowed the rail transportation and the safety department, looking for the improved rule compliance program procedure that they have. And during that, we went out to the stations, looked for human errors that WMATA looks for in their day-to-day activities and their rule compliance BlackBerry checks. And we reviewed a lot of the information that they collect and made recommendations to enhance that rule compliance study, which they're currently reviewing our recommendations. So we're waiting on a response on that. The mock review of ourselves, the TOC, we had individuals come in from different parts, different other agencies, and review the interactions between ourselves, the TOC, and WMATA, and how we do our accident investigations and our CAP adoptions. And they also made recommendations, which we are currently using to enhance the program. CAP process issues. As I said, the CAP spreadsheet, FCA's recommended that we work together to create a new, improved CAP spreadsheet, more in line to outline the milestones and the next steps. And on a spreadsheet itself may be kind of difficult, but I envision some kind of almost like a Gantt chart that would be used on specific caps, long-term caps that we could use maybe as a link in the spreadsheet that we could link to a Gantt chart or something. But FTA has been asked to provide templates that we can work together with, and they have told us that they will be here in January to follow through with that.
And if we can do something to increase the size of the print, it would help. Hey.
I think that's what the goal is, to make it a little easier to read and understand.
I have
and
to get
everybody.
My magnifying glass out every month. Yes, Tony.
Yeah, amen to that. But also, what's the time frame on wrapping that up? Because, you know, it's evolved as a document, and I think it's got some good things in it, and I certainly would encourage the milestones and current status elements of it, but we'd like to certainly wrap it up. You know, it's like I don't want this to be a 10-year project to develop the perfect reporting spreadsheet.
You're correct, and thank you, Ron. And we also have to be consider the fact that the safety measurement system would have to be incorporated in this spreadsheet, and IT professionals would have to get involved and help develop this. So I'm not sure the exact deadline, but yes, it would be nice to get that wrapped up. Next slide. Capture meetings. We're trying to improve our communication at the capture meetings so A lot of times what we get is documentation to review in the CAP meetings, and we're asking that all the capture documents be submitted prior to the meeting so we can review them and we can have meaningful conversation with any concerns or any kind of questions can be addressed at those meetings. Next slide. CAPS by department, we closely monitor the CAPS by department, and we try to arrange meetings with those departments to address those CAPS. We look forward to this December and January to arrange some meetings to try to get some of these CAPS closed out from the 2010 triennial as well as the internal safety audits. Next slide. As I said, the capital projects that we're overseeing is the 7,000 vehicle procurement. We're attending safety certification working groups and safety certification meetings, the Dulles Startup Committee meetings, Dulles Corridor Metro Rail Project working groups, and we do have the secretaries attending next week out at the Dulles Transit Partners to get a front bird's eye view of the system. Next slide. The three-year reviews. As I said, we're due to begin our 2013 triennial review next year. It is quite an undertaking, and we have proposed a different style of doing it. We would like to, instead of coming in and doing the whole system all at one time, which is quite an undertaking, to spread that out over a three-year period, much the same as the internal safety audits are done on a per quarter basis. So you would just do one department a quarter or two departments a quarter versus every department all at once. We feel that that would be a more effective way of performing the triennial audit. We've created a white paper that's well written and submitted that to OMATA for review, and we're working on that. And if you have any questions on any of those, I'd be interested in answering.
Questions? Since the last time you were here, I guess the last time you were here was very shortly after the legislation had passed that gave FTA greater safety jurisdiction. They're now in their first fiscal year, although they're on continuing resolution, which I think is not giving them all the resources they would like. But is there a changed relationship with FTA now as they have a clearer jurisdiction over safety?
Not that we have noticed up to this point, no.
The relationship still is that you are their agent, and as they exercise their jurisdiction, it's being largely exercised through you.
We do understand that they're going to provide funding for the oversight, so that will be one change. Standards will be developed, but they won't be developed overnight. They will take a long time coming and be an ongoing process. So.
And you'll be involved.
And we'll be involved
in the development of that.
Okay. As well as other states.
Yes. Yeah, there are how many, 20 agencies around the country, I think?
I'm not sure of the number there.
Other questions? If not, thank you.
Well, thank you.
See you again in 3 months, if not more frequently in between.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. We'll talk.
All right. The next agenda item is an update on the fatigue risk management system. And we'll hear the progress that's been made there. We already heard that provision is being made in the budget to implement those recommendations. And I think you'll find it interesting as we go through the presentation that the concern over fatigue has moved even beyond the simple, we got to keep everybody at 14 hours. So I think that's still important. And you all were given in the material for this meeting an indication of how many employees that might affect. We're now looking at within the hours that individuals work, are there patterns that in fact could lead to fatigue even if their hourly employment has been curtailed? So clearly we're working hard on this issue, and I will turn it over to you for the presentation.
Thank you, Chairman Downey. Good morning, members of the board. In July of this year, we presented the board an update on WMATA's ongoing efforts to establish a fatigue risk management system, or FMS, FRMS, as it's called. In keeping with the committee's request, we are here again today to provide you an update on the steps that we have taken since July. Displayed on the monitor are four general building blocks on which we're building our FRMS, which we shared with you back, or Dr. Hirsch actually shared with you back in the July presentation. In July 2011, in 2011, the Tri-State Oversight Committee, with the assistance of Safety and Rail Operations, conducted a study and provided their assessment of fatigue awareness and management in our Rail Operations Group. In some cases, it was observed that employees work in substantial hours, sparking a concern as to the safety and health of our employees. Considering developments in sleep science, the NTSB recommendations, data from other modes of transportation, and the data developed from the TOC study, we might have chose to conduct a more comprehensive study looking not only at rail, but at all of WMATA, with the initial phases of the study focused on a subset of our safety-sensitive employees in bus and rail operations defined as safety-critical employees. And those are actually the folks that we have the positions identified and the vulnerability to fatigue-related errors that have a direct impact on safety of the public and other employees. In looking at the safety-critical employees in bus operations, we focused on the bus transportation operators and the bus maintenance mechanics. The employees in these safety-critical groups are represented by either Local 689 or 922. Written into our labor agreements is a de facto 16-hour limit on the number of hours that a Metro bus operator can be on duty. However, there are no set limits for the total number of days that an employee can work, and currently no formal fatigue policy. Let me emphasize, though, that the findings from the bus study are based on data from July 2011, the same month that the TOC WMATA rail study occurred. Since that time, though, significant hiring and management actions have brought about improvements in the work distribution. In this graph, starting with bus transportation, our survey found that the vast majority of operators work 40 hours or fewer within a week, and most operators work a maximum of 5 days per week. The study did identify a bus transportation group of 9% of the employees who worked in a range of 12 to 16 hours per day, but there were fewer than 1% of the operators who worked were greater than the 16-hour limit. We found that less than 1%, or 42 occurrences, of the employees that worked more than 5 days per week in the time frame surveyed. In the bus maintenance group, we found that although a majority of the maintenance personnel worked no more than 12 hours a day, 36% of the work days exceeded 12 hours. And in less than 1%, or 8 cases, the employee worked more than 16 hours. Much like bus transportation, the majority of the employees worked within a 40-hour, 5-day work week, with only 25 instances where an employee worked more than 5 days consecutively. We found that the percentage of employees that worked outside of the 40 hours per week was higher at 36%. However, there were no work weeks that exceeded a 70-hour total. 70, yes, sir. In looking at the data, we found there to be no significant areas that would provide a high level of concern towards fatigue among these employee groups as a whole. However, we recognize the importance of addressing any outliers. Since the study was completed and the results have been shared with the bus operations group, they have taken many steps to prevent fatigue related to long work hours. Bus operations has modified its practice to include a monitoring process that pays special attention to an employee working a high number of hours. In the instance that any employee works significant overtime on a weekly basis, that being over 20 hours in bus maintenance or 24 hours in bus transportation, justification must be provided. Since the implementation of this practice, the number of employees working substantial hours has decreased significantly, with only one employee being identified as an outlier. In order to ensure that we have a well-composed fatigue program, we're working with the Institutes for Behavioral Resources to take a more scientific approach, for both bus and rail employees. With the use of the Fatigue Avoidance Scheduling Tool, or FAST,
Dr. Stephen Hirsch and his staff looked at trapeze scheduling data of 537 rail operators and 2,480 bus operators, all within that safety critical group. The FAST system applies a biomathematical model that evaluates fatigue based on hours worked, time of day, and estimates for effective sleep. Now I'd like to bring up Dr. Stephen Hirsch to provide the board with the results of the FAST software modeling. Dr. Hirsch?
Good morning. We looked at the work hours data available to us from the trapeze work hours management system for 537 rail operators and 2,480 bus operators, and this was in the month of April of 2012. These data were then processed through the safety FAST fatigue model. Data for other safety critical groups that are not managed by that system will be examined in the next phase of the study.
All right. We considered all work hours, both scheduled and overtime. Bus operator pool was divided into two groups, A and B, simply to facilitate the management of large data files, but they were otherwise similar. The safety FAST model estimates the timing of sleep in relation to work hours performed and uses a set of working assumptions listed here on this chart. These have been validated in studies we've conducted with the Federal Railroad Administration in populations similar to these, but not identical. These assumptions will be validated in upcoming studies of actual sleep in a representative sample of employees. We found that a significant driver of fatigue was the amount of nighttime work, defined as critical hours between midnight and 8 a.m. For the purposes of this modeling analysis, we assumed that employees who work split assignments, that is, assignments that involve work in the morning and then later in the afternoon, that during that time of interim release that there would not be any opportunities for taking naps.
That's a model assumption, not a real world.
That's a modeling assumption. It's a worst case assumption, and that will be validated and verified when we collect actual logbook data that I'll talk about in a moment. Now, this chart shows the profile of effectiveness of rail operators. Effectiveness is the metric that comes out of the model. High effectiveness is highly alert employees. Low effectiveness could be associated with less alertness and fatigue. Each bar indicates the number of work hours that were performed with an effectiveness of a particular effectiveness value that's shown on the x-axis of the chart. For example, if you look at the point at 70, 3% of work hours in the rail operations were performed with an effectiveness level of 70 or less. This represents what you would call the tail of the distribution that poses important fatigue risk, and fatigue risk management initiatives should be designed to reduce or eliminate the work times with low levels of effectiveness. We looked at each individual schedule to determine which schedules had more than 20% of work time with an effectiveness below 70, and this happens to be the Federal Railroad Administration's threshold for excessive fatigue that requires specific mitigation. When we looked at night work hours, it was discovered that this was a major driver of fatigue in this group of employees, is the large amount of work that occurs in some employees, just a small group of employees, who work large amounts of hours between midnight and 8 a.m. And this is when they work greater than 90 hours in that window of time. This is work that aligns with the period of circadian low when people tend to be less alert. But these kinds of work hours also deprive these operators of good quality sleep because they will otherwise have to sleep during the daytime. So that was a major driver of fatigue. But when we looked at total work hours per month, for these operators, there was at most a very mild relationship between total work hours per month and fatigue. Only 8% of the variance in performance could be traced to the total hours they worked per month. On the other hand, 84% of the variance in performance could be traced to the total amount of night work between midnight and 8 a.m. Hence, limiting the hours of work by itself without consideration of time of day will not address the fundamental fatigue problem. For rail operators, nearly all of the employees with excessive fatigue, according to the Federal Railroad Administration's criteria, had high amounts of night work. but this was 6 to 7% of rail schedules in this group. This represents about 37 employees out of 537 overall who had 90 hours of night work or more. We will be looking at these schedules to determine how those night work hours can be mitigated to reduce fatigue. Remember, this analysis is based on modeling and estimates the amount of sleep, so it is only an indicator of potential fatigue and not demonstrated or measured fatigue. Follow-on studies will actually look closer at these schedules to examine what their actual amounts of sleep are to get a better estimate of actual fatigue.
In your memo that came to us, I don't see it on the slides, but I think it's a very important fact. Operating at a 70% level of effectiveness is the point you would be at if you had 8 hours sleep and then worked 21 straight hours. Is mm-hmm. that correct?
Right.
Yeah. So that's why we want
yes.
to avoid
that. Well, the reason that 70 was chosen by the Federal Railroad Administration is that when we conducted a study of accidents, that when operators had effectiveness below 70, they had a significant, demonstrated significant elevation in the risk of having an accident. So it's a very useful criteria for examining schedules. I'm not a real fan of bright lines because you can't necessarily eliminate all fatigue in 24/7 operations. But 70 is a good metric for assessing our schedules and trying to minimize the amount of time below 70.
Yeah, thank you. This
sure.
is very interesting. I'm glad Mort mentioned the assumed 8 hours of sleep, this kind of thing. My concern is that in reality, there's an X percentage of the population that suffers from sleep apnea as it is. So even that being factored in, we don't really know at this point. And I guess my concern is you suggested future studies in this of actual people. I know in my own surroundings of friends and colleagues, 30% of them have some form of sleep apnea.
Right.
What are the national numbers on this right now on an average of?
It varies quite a lot between work groups. And I think the more important thing is for that WMATA does have an initiative underway to look at sleep apnea and its employees. We're not the organization managing that study, but we are looking. We're taking it very seriously. I can't take credit for that. That's something that WMATA is doing with another contractor. But sleep apnea is a considerable important problem. We will be looking at training and awareness programs within WMATA to make sure that all employees understand the real serious health and safety risk of having a sleep disorder, particularly sleep apnea, so that their elevation of awareness is increased and that they will take personal measures to get themselves examined and treated. But there's another slide later where we'll talk about actually collecting sleep data from our employees, which will help to further confirm or expand on our assessment at this point using modeling. Now, this chart shows the profile of effectiveness for the two groups of bus operators were virtually identical. We divided them simply for convenience of the large data sets. And with effectiveness at 70, for example, only 1% of work hours were performed below that criteria. So the bus operators, in general, have lower levels of fatigue. And when we looked at individual schedules, only 0.4% of all bus schedules had more than 20% of time below effectiveness of 70, which is the FRA criteria for mitigation. This equates to 10 schedules out of 2,480 employees. And all of these schedules involved early morning starts between 3 a.m. and 5 a.m. And nearly all of these schedules would be mitigated if the employees were trained and were able to start their night of sleep at 2,200 hours, at 10 o'clock or earlier. So part of this with those employees is to assure that they're aware that having to start work at 3 o'clock in the morning necessitates that they advance their time of sleep to an earlier hour. And if they were to do so, most, if not all, of this fatigue would be mitigated. So in summary then, for rail operators, 67% of operators exceed the FRA criteria fatigue, and the major cause of this fatigue is the is in these in this 627. 627. Sorry. Boy, that would be a major problem, sir. Sorry. I'll repeat it again. 627% of operators exceed the FRA criteria. The major cause of this fatigue is the large amount of work time between midnight and 8 a.m. for this small group of employees. So the next step is to examine those set schedules and mitigate the fatigue associated with night work hours. Now, we must recognize that some work must be done at night, like building the trains that are put in service for the morning rush hour. We can't eliminate the work. It's got to be done. So the question is, how can we arrange these schedules and train these employees to assure that they have adequate sleep to be alert when they're operating at these hours of the day? Now, for bus operators, there was only 0.4% of bus operators would have excessive fatigue by the FRA's criteria, and most, if not all, of that would be mitigated if these employees were trained to adapt their sleep habits to an earlier bedtime. So the next phase of the study is to go further and collect actual data from employees. The modeling work only provides a first estimate of potential fatigue and did not cover all safety critical groups. So the next phase, which will commence in February, and the objective of that study is to survey and collect logbooks of actual work time, commute times, and sleep hours to characterize sleep patterns in a representative sample of employees in safety critical groups to determine the relationship between their work schedule and their actual sleep. Now, on this chart, there are two numbers beside each of these operator groups. The larger number is the number of randomly selected employees who will be mailed surveys and logs to be filled out. And the smaller number is the required sample size to have a representative sample, and that's based on a 33% return rate. So we are going to oversample, send out more than we need, in the assumption that only a third will come back. But if we get a third back, we will meet our targets for having a representative sample. And the one-third was not pulled out of the air. We have done five of these studies with other agencies, and a 33% response rate is highly expected, and we probably will do better because we're going to provide some incentives for them to participate. These data will serve to validate and optimize the sleep assumptions of the Safety Fast model, and is key to verifying the implications of that analysis. For this, for example, for the bus operators, these data will tell us how operators with early morning shifts adjust their sleep times to obtain sufficient rest, or maybe not, but we'll find out by having these data. All the results will be treated as confidential and will be de-identified. After all, we want voluntary participation. So only aggregated results will be provided to WMATA to protect the identity of the employees and to ensure their cooperation. And I think we all understand that. So the data collection is scheduled to start in February of 2013 with a final report out to WMATA in the spring of 2013. Yes. Yeah, there's going to be a smaller group of individuals who will be fitted with actigraphs. And an actigraph is an electronic device that they wear. It passively records their activity patterns and is a very accurate predictor of sleep. We will not be fitting actigraphs with this large number of employees. That would be unfeasible to do. But we will be selecting groups, targeted groups, to collect these kind of data. For example, and we haven't fully determined who will be putting actigraphs on, it will have to be volunteers, but take that group of 37 employees that have lots of night hours. It would be great to have actigraphs on some of those employees to see how they're adapting their sleep patterns to those night work. Those people may be specially trained to work that kind of schedule. That may be their special skill to do those jobs. Let's see if they're adapting their sleep patterns to be rested and fully alert during those schedules. Yes, sir.
The actigraph's just like a watch, so it's not a big device. Here's a full timeline for the fatigue risk management system. As we just discussed, our first step is to gather the data and analysis to address the safety critical positions. We then plan to address the remainder of the safety sensitive positions, and at the same time work on building the education awareness, training, and employee sleep health components. This effort is being guided by an executive steering committee and an operational committee, with labor as an invited partner. I would certainly like to thank the leadership of our labor organizations for their patience, advice, and encouragement as we move through this process. I believe that there is a growing recognition that preventing and mitigating fatigue is truly a common undertaking that involves all of us, regardless of our roles at WMATA. We will work into May of 2014 with contractor support to ensure that the system is complete and sufficiently mature, and that, one, we know it is working as intended, and two, we can maintain it with success. We have learned through the process that the issues causing fatigue encompasses much more than just hours worked. And in order to address fatigue in employees, we are and must take a complete look at all the factors that can cause fatigue. Through the efforts of the Fatigue Project, we are gaining a greater corporate awareness of the issue of fatigue, and at the conclusion of this project, we will have a program that will provide an even safer environment for our employees and customers. And as always, as we continue to make progress along this road, we will report to the board committee with our findings and recommendations. And that would conclude the presentation.
Thank you, Chair.
Nichols.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your presentation. Could you speak for a moment on the impact and your perspectives on stimulants and use of stimulants, prescribed, non-prescribed, everything from coffee to you name it, but what's the impact of stimulants on the issues that we're discussing
right
now, please?
It's a very good question. You know, we're all, and I see a look around the room, I think, oh, good for you, sir. But that's because you got 8 hours of sleep last night and you don't need any coffee, right? The use of stimulants is ubiquitous, and there have been an enormous amount of studies done on the effects of caffeine. And generally speaking, caffeine in and of itself, if you take it in moderation, is not a health threat, and can actually be quite beneficial in maintaining alertness at times of the day when we would otherwise be degraded, like at 4 o'clock in the morning. But there are lots of things that you need to train employees with respect to the proper use of caffeine. You should not take caffeine within 6 to 8 hours of trying to get sleep, because it's going to interfere with the quality of your sleep. You shouldn't be using caffeine sort of as a recreational beverage, because then when you really need it to maintain alertness at critical points of safety, then it's not going to be very beneficial because you're tolerant to it. So there are things that, you know, caffeine can be useful in moderation and appropriately used, but needs to be supported by adequate training. Other stimulants, I think that's something that is certainly not something that we would advise using. Caffeine is freely available, and there's no way we're going to eliminate the use of caffeine, but it needs to be done with good training.
Just put a quick follow-on to that.
Yes, sir.
Understanding that it is advisable not to use other stimulants, can you offer comments, your observations, professional observations on the incidence of using other stimulants, not with respect necessarily to WMATA, but globally in the industry? How much of an impact is that on our industry?
Yeah, I frankly don't have at my fingertips any numbers on how many people are using amphetamines and other kinds of stimulants. And I certainly don't know what it would be in this population. It varies from work group to work group, and I really don't have the data, but I can certainly look it up to see if there's any information on that.
DeVolter, and then Ms. Porter.
I'm interested in knowing whether there's going to be a correlation in the second phase here of what you told us earlier today about how overtime has gone through the roof. Is that going to be part of this methodology?
First of all, with regard to overtime, in July, we had very high heat streak, which required us to do a number of things, a lot of track inspections, dealing with hot cars to make sure we had the fleet available, a number of things, and that was an appropriate application, in my view, of overtime. We are, what we don't want are people just working overtime to collect overtime. That's why there's this management effort underway to do that. We do not want, we want to look at schedules, as was mentioned before, which will have the effect probably of reducing overtime to make sure people are scheduled right, to take away these areas where there's a potential fatigue factor. So there's not a direct correlation, if you will. But there, because, again, we try to manage when that overtime is done. There is certainly some overlap between the two, but there is not a direct correlation.
In terms of budget risks, that may be one of the other things we want to look at, is how many times in a typical year do we have to have an overtime
spike? Exactly. And part of, helping solve that issue has been to fill the vacancies. That's another part of the issue, which we've been working on.
Ms. Porter and then Mr. Downs.
I remember reading somewhere that another risk factor for fatigue is shifting working hours, in other words, going from a day shift to a night shift or to an evening shift. But this is a point in time study. You're not following an employee over a period of time to see whether they switch their working hours. And so I guess the question would be, is there a way to pick up some of that in this study? And perhaps the second question would be, do we in fact look at this issue and try and minimize the amount of shifting working time that an individual employee would need to do?
Well, I think the first part of the answer is that fatigue science is not clear on whether shifting your time of work is necessarily a driver of fatigue. There are some who believe that that is true. I'm not one of them. I don't believe that necessarily shifting your time of work is detrimental. For example, having an employee that works only at night is maybe worse than having that employee work some of their work at night and some of their work during the daytime, so at least some of the time they have opportunities to sleep at night. If we were to mandate that no one shifted their schedules, that employee would have to work do all their work at night, and that would probably be detrimental. So I think that the premise that shifting your work time is in of itself a driver of fatigue is probably not well supported by the science.
Shifting time zones is a factor, but we don't fortunately have to deal with that.
Shifting time zones is a factor, the tools that we use are used heavily in aviation, where pilots do shift time zones, and what we do with pilots is suggest that they try to keep their sleep time as close to home time as possible, even though their wake time may be shifting around. So there are ways to mitigate. Even the shifting of your work doesn't necessarily mean that you have to shift your sleep.
Mr. Downs, and then Ms. Bowser.
I think it's important to acknowledge the context in which the Federal Railroad Administration uses this model. As you and I both know, the Federal Railroad Administration imposes strict limits on hours of service per day and per week.
Mm-hmm.
I think they did it, at least in the regulatory environment where they proposed doing this, that while it may be a blunt tool, it is a safety feature,
mm-hmm,
guaranteeing uniform application of hours of work standards. So that's how this model is utilized, at least within the Federal Railroad Administration.
Mm-hmm.
The second is a recognition of the context that we operate in now, that we do not control hours of overtime effectively in this organization,
mm-hmm,
because we have a right of overtime by seniority. Even having people turn in earlier as a mitigation measure does not mean that they're not going to wind up potentially working a double or triple shift. That is simply beyond management's mm-hmm control. I'd like to make a suggestion. There have been press reports that we've had our bus drive cam in effect have rapid braking caused by bus operators who have actually fallen asleep at the wheel of a bus. I think 63 of those incidences were recorded. Without trying to assign blame or about disciplinary processes, an in-depth look at each of the, I consider each of those a failure of a system of sorts, to look at the bus operators' hours of service, sleep pattern, medical history, how that individual came to be operating a bus in a state that allowed him or her to fall asleep at the wheel of a bus, seems to be a laboratory for learning more about the real world of this, and have that be part of a review of the safety committee for lessons learned, I think would be helpful for all of us.
I'd like Jack to just talk about when we do observe that in drive cam, what we've done in terms of looking at the work hours and that sort of thing for those individuals.
When we see a drive cam clip of that indicates that there's been some heavy braking and that the operator's eyes appear to be shut during the incident, whether they've hit any other vehicle or not. On a few occasions, they have bumped the vehicle in front of them, but we've had no serious accidents. But in all those cases, the operator is coached, but most importantly, the operator is sent immediately to medical, taken out of service, sent to medical for an evaluation, and if sleep apnea is an issue, they're put in a sleep apnea program, and so there's a medical evaluation of that operator, and he or she is not put back to service until they've cleared medical. As mentioned earlier, we're trying to control overtime and are controlling overtime. We do evaluate the hours worked to the operator, the type of work that he's doing, and certainly in coaching, we want to make sure in the event, especially if there's been no accident involved, that, you know, that the operators are preparing themselves to come to work in good condition.
But I'd be also interested about what their schedule's impact was, mm-hmm. and whether or not they had outside employment, and the other factors that have been raised about vulnerability to diminished capacity. And I think falling asleep at the wheel of a bus is way below 70.
We certainly evaluate the hours that the when there's an incident like this, we evaluate the hours that the operator has worked. We don't control outside work. We don't have a clear definition of whether there is outside work or not.
And under the project that we're participating in, there is going to be a component where we will look at a sample of accident reports, and we will be subjecting them to a close scientific scrutiny with all the available data. So we will, and I agree with you, it's a great laboratory for looking through the telescope the other way to see what that can tell us about the conditions that might be producing excessive fatigue, and we will be doing that.
Go ahead. Question of Ms. Bowser, Mr. Giancola, Ms. Dyke, and then we'll go to the next agenda item.
I guess my first question is, when you talk about the bus drivers, it looks like you're pointing to this 3 a.m. start as the biggest driver of fatigue. Are there other employees that start at that time? Or are the bus drivers the only ones that have this 3 a.m. start?
Yeah, I can't speak to that since I've only looked at the bus drivers at this stage. Maybe some of the other managers could speak to that.
Awesome.
I've looked at bus and rail, and of those two both have people that start at those hours or work at those hours. Beyond that,
I'll speak to the maintenance employees in bus maintenance. Our midnight shift begins at 10:30 and ends at 7, so there's a concentration of hours within that midnight 8-hour period. But I think from your evaluation that there's not an issue with that.
What we have a little bit.
Obviously, I guess they all have to wrap at that time to get ready for the morning rush hour, and there's no feasible way to push it earlier or later. Because obviously, if you go to sleep a little bit during the night and you're woken up, to get to work. I can see how that is the most disruptive shift. My next question is, so you're suggesting that bedtime should begin at 10 p.m. for those workers?
Well, what I'm suggesting is that if those employees would be trained and could get to bed earlier on those days when they have those early starts, that that would help to mitigate the fatigue, because they have that additional hour or more of sleep is very beneficial in making sure that when they're working those hours in the middle of the night, they aren't adding to that the problems of sleep debt. And that's simply exaggerates the lack of alertness that you would normally have anyway.
And are our procedures for overtime or any scheduling, would that prevent those workers from working beyond that 2,200 hours?
Yeah, I don't know.
Because I think what you're suggesting, it sounds like, is they should be in bed by 10, no later than 10. So is there a system in place that would prevent them from working a shift beyond 10 p.m. on the previous day?
Yeah, I'm not sure that there is a system, but then I think that you make a very good point, though, that when we start to look at ways to mitigate nighttime work, we need to look at protecting the time before those shifts to ensure that they have at least an opportunity for 8 hours of sleep leading into a nighttime shift. And if that means somehow examining the way we do overtime so that people are given an opportunity to be fit for duty before a night shift, that's something that we should look at.
What's the state now?
Well, let me speak from a bus operator standpoint. If we know that an operator is due in at 4 or 5 in the morning, we know that we have to give that operator at least 8 hours off before that time. So if he or she takes some overtime, and if the shift is actually longer, we'll split the shift in half and give it to that person for a period of time to make sure they get adequate time off, and then bring somebody else on that doesn't have that limitation to try to cover the rest of the work. So, you know, we're guided by at least 8 full hours off, and we certainly know if we exceed that, then we have to change the hours of work that the person starts the next day, which complicates another problem. So we try to resolve it all in the one day.
Mr. Giancola, and then
thank you. You mentioned there's going to be follow-on surveys.
Yes.
And I don't know whether you already have this incorporated in your survey, and I don't know. I guess we'd have to check the legality of asking this question, but I'm assuming the responses are anonymous. Be interested to know how many do use stimulants to stay awake during their shift. In other words, do you continuously use stimulants, or have you used stimulants to stay awake? If so, what have you used? Be interesting to see how many say coffee or Red Bull or whatever they may.
There is a question about that.
All right, good. Thank you.
And Mr. Dyke.
Quick question. Could you elaborate on the comment here where you talk about secondary employment policy seems unenforceable? Could you just elaborate a little bit on that?
As part of the whole program, we certainly are looking at secondary employment. In the rail rule book, actually, there is a rule that actually addresses, I'll just say, you know, being prepared for sleep or outside employment, you know, that states employees shall not engage in outside employment instructional courses or other activities that are competitive with, interfere with, or adversely affect the performance of duties, or deprive the employee of having at least 8 consecutive hours off in every 24 consecutive hour period. So we are going to certainly look at that, as well as looking at creating a fatigue policy for the organization.
So has there been an effort to try to, I gather from this you're saying it's unenforceable. That means there has not been an effort, or you're just saying you just want to look at it?
I would say, you know, as far as we're going to look at it to see what we can do to tighten it up, but we can't control what people do in their off time. What we can control is the number of hours that they're scheduled to work. But as far as what they do within their time that's available to them, we don't have control over that while they're off duty. And if Dave or Jack.
There was a news report yesterday on another property where an employee involved in an accident was turned out, had a second job, and he was terminated.
Yeah, and there was a rule against it.
Yeah.
That's part of the reason why, when we modified the rule book and went through this, we ensured that we embedded that into this new rule book process, knowing that this is an ongoing effort and, you know, part of our investigation process. But without it, you know, then we don't really didn't have a basis to start from. But by us having it in place, we've got another tool to work with. Okay. It's a very complex process, as y'all know.
Thank you.
Okay. We're eating into the time of the Planning Committee, but we still have one more agenda item, which is the employee survey. We do that fairly quickly. Thank you, Dr. Hirsch.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate it.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. As a bit of background, you will recall that in 2010, WMATA conducted an employee survey to determine a baseline for establishing a safety culture. Some of the key themes to emerge during that survey were that retaliation was a key driver in non-reporting of safety issues by employees, inconsistency across Metro in addressing safety concerns, and closing the loop with employees when safety issues were appropriately addressed. When the safety survey was originally conducted, it was envisioned that there would be a follow-up survey in 2 years to measure the agency's progress. The GM decided to take a more comprehensive approach and not only measure progress on efforts to improve the safety culture, but also engagement of the workforce overall, which is vital to safety as well as the overall agency's performance. As such, in September of this year, WMATA worked with the Hay Group to conduct an employee engagement survey to measure key aspects of workforce environment, including employee engagement, performance management, leadership, as well as our progress in improving our safety culture. I'd like to point out, however, that the executive leadership team has not yet had an opportunity to review the final detailed report of the results, but our intent is to do a deeper dive and a more thorough review and analysis of those results so that we can identify key objectives, key priorities, and develop action plans to begin to address them. So at this time, I'd like to introduce Jody Semko of the Hay Group, who will share with you the high-level results of the survey and some key themes that emerged. Jody.
Good morning. So first, just to talk a little bit more about the process, as Tanya mentioned, you know, the survey was a broad-based survey to get at safety, engagement, performance management, and other things that we know are critical to creating a high-performing organization and to making sure that our employees are both engaged, meaning they want to go above and beyond to be successful, they're committed to the organization, as well as enabled, that they're in an environment that allows them to be successful. Ultimately, the real goal of this survey is to make change at both the WMATA-wide and the local level. We will be providing results in the January timeframe down to the business function and department level, but really coming up with some action plans for addressing the issues that come out of the survey is really critical for us to see some change based on the survey. The survey was administered to all WMATA employees in a paper or web format, and 64% of the workforce, over 6,000 employees, participate in the survey. That response rate is above average of what we typically see in similar types of workforces, transient workforces, highly unionized, as well as heavy based on paper. We typically see that. Recently, you may have read that the federal government does a survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoints Survey, and that survey just came out, the results were just published, and that response rate was only 46%. So many of the federal agencies were well below what we see here at WMATA and other organizations that we see. The key themes that I'm going to talk about today that came out of the survey are safety, employee engagement and leadership, job support, and performance management. So I'm going to start with safety. Overall, safety scores were amongst the highest in this employee engagement survey. There's evidence by the survey, at least from a culture standpoint, that there's been significant progress in creating that safety culture. Many of the concerns, as Tanya raised, that came out of the last survey are now key strengths for WMATA. As you can see, some of the data here, 92% of employees know how to report a safety issue. 83% indicated that they've been trained adequately to do their job, and 80% indicated that their supervisors communicate with them about safety-related issues. And that was that question around communication was only 59.6% in 2010, and the communication, as you can see, has increased to 80%. So some great improvements. Additionally, on the next slide, one of the most critical things that came out of the last survey, as Tanya mentioned, was people's comfort reporting a safety incident without fear of retaliation by their coworkers. 85% of employees in this survey indicated that they can freely report a safety issue concern without fear of retaliation. In the prior survey, those that had observed and not reported an incident were asked why they did not. And a third of those folks indicated that it was because of fear of retaliation. So we wanted to ask this question of the entire workforce, get a sense of the culture for reporting, and as you can see, very high results. 53% indicated that they had observed a safety violation or concern. In the 2010 survey, it was 59.6%. So as you can see, there's over a 6 percentage point drop from the 2010 survey. Okay. I'd like to now switch over to employee engagement and leadership. As I mentioned, one of the critical things to measure is how engaged our employees are. We know this is a critical driver of how satisfied customers are, retention of talent, financial performance. We've established links between having an engaged workforce in an environment where they can be successful. Very favorable results here. 79% of WMATA employees indicated they're proud to work for WMATA, and they would recommend the organization as a place to work. To put that in context, if you look at the would recommend the organization as a place to work, Hay Group has several norms. We do employee surveys across industries. We have one that is our U.S. norm, which is all the organizations, approximately 150 that we work with. We also, in partnership with WMATA, created a custom norm that really was focused on workforces that are similar, highly unionized, blue-collar. Your scores on the 79% recommend are higher than our norms. Also, if you look at the federal government-wide average from the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey I mentioned previously, 67% of the federal government employees feel they would recommend their agency as a place to work. So these are very favorable findings. 75% indicate that they plan to stay with WMATA for 5 years or more. So what's really driving this engagement in terms of what the survey results show us? Well, employees are very clear about the mission here at WMATA, and we know clarity around the mission is one of the biggest drivers of engagement. They also find their jobs challenging, interesting, and making good use of their skills and abilities. 92% of them feel their work contributes to the success of WMATA, so they see the link between the work they do and the success of WMATA. Also, high ratings and above our norms on opportunities for career development, for advancement, for learning here at WMATA. Now, in order to continue to maintain and even increase employee engagement, one of the things that could be done is to build more trust in leadership and more open communications. And what we typically find is very similar here at WMATA, that people tend to have trust and confidence more in their supervisors, people they know, people they interact with on a day-to-day basis, less confidence in middle managers, and the least amount of confidence in senior leadership. And thinking about WMATA as an organization, you have a lot of people in the field, you know, bus operators, train operators. They have a lot more connection with their supervisor than with leadership. We know leadership is a critical driver of engagement, so that's a great lever to pull to be able to maintain and improve engagement. Next area is job support. It's really providing employees with an environment so they're what we call enabled to be successful. We found that there's a high level of employees that feel they have the authority and the information to do their jobs well. There are some opportunities around cooperation and sharing of ideas and resources across WMATA. You see 25% of people do not see this as a strong point. Also opportunities for enhancing the service provided by departments, divisions to each other so that people have the support they need to do their jobs and to go out and satisfy the customers out there. And finally, looking at how up-to-date the vehicles, the facilities, and the equipment are. So those are some areas in job support that could be improved. The last area in terms of the themes that we looked at across the survey were performance-based culture. You know, there are opportunities to, you know, increase the focus on performance, recognition, and feedback to create that performance-based culture. Many of the organizations that I've worked with over the past 20 years, that is a typical challenge. If you look at the federal government-wide results, this has been a challenge for the federal government for many years. The results tend to show that. So basically, employees, over 20% of employees would like to see more feedback, coaching, recognition. One in two do not see a clear link between rewards and their performance. And a good number do not feel that performance is adequately addressed. Now, there are things going on at WMATA, such as the vital signs report and the focus on key indicators that could be pushed down, you know, to all employees so that they have clear goals around, you know, how they can impact the success of WMATA. In terms of next steps, as Tanya mentioned, we're in the initial stages of reviewing the data. We have a lot more analysis to do. A lot more follow-up to do. We'll be meeting with the ELT to give the full brief out in early January. We will also be working with the ELT to come up with two or three priorities to work on. We don't want to pick too many things to work on. We really want to focus on two to three things that we can do well that have the biggest impact on the business. And then we will be distributing the reports for the business functions and the departments so that they can look at their data and identify, you know, a few areas that they want to work on to improve the local workplace environment. So I open up for questions.
Mr. Chancellor.
Yeah, thank you for the report. It's somewhat expected in some areas, but also very interesting. Did you ask in the area of job support, which is page 49, when you ask them about facilities, equipment, and vehicles, 23% believe they're in need of modernization. Were there any specifics? Did they have a blank to use to fill in some information about what they thought needed to be modernized and things such as that?
There wasn't a blank. We are still reviewing. There were a few questions at the end of the survey, open-ended questions, and we are in the process of reviewing the themes around that and going through the qualitative data. And then, you know, there is the possibility of doing some more deeper digging in the future to get at some of these
Yeah, it would be
issues.
Interesting to see that, particularly if there's some correlation. Yeah. There's maybe all 23% mentioned one thing or not, or there was a high percentage mentioning one or more items. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, a quick question, and as a way of where I'm going with this, is relates to a question I want to ask when we talk about Silver Line later, and that is the point where we talk about better cross-organizational support. Was that found to be structural, that there was not an opportunity to do that, or was it just personality or what, that there was not a talking or working amongst the various departments within the agency?
Yeah, I mean, we don't have that level of detail yet. We're still going to go through the open-ended, but most of the survey questions were, you know, that question was really just asked in general. There were two. The one worded was, do you feel that there is good collaboration and sharing of ideas and resources across WMATA? And the other one was, do you get good support from departments and divisions on which you depend? So the next step in this process is to dig deeper into some of these opportunities for improvement. The survey kind of is a great opportunity to give you some red flags and to begin to look at the themes, but we find that when we peel the onion back and dig a little deeper, we can find out a lot more to help us to develop an effective action plan to address that issue so that we know what's causing that issue and what the root causes are.
I would just add to that is when The surveys were done and the information was with regard to safety, and the reports from NTSB and everything else. This place was defined as being heavily siloed. And that's something you don't change overnight. Yes, the answer is yes, heavily siloed. Moving away from that, got a lot more work to do.
All right, well, that was the point, because I said I'll wait till we get to the 1 o'clock presentation, but that was an issue that popped up in some things I was hearing. Okay, thank you.
And the safety survey of 2 years ago really did set a roadmap for things we needed to improve upon, and I think this one suggests we have made some progress, so hope for the rest. Mr. Nichols, Mr. Downs, Ms. Hampshire.
Thank you very much and for the presentation, and I had a question regarding employee engagement.
Yeah.
The slide there, and this may be in a later phase of your data analysis, but do you have observations around any stratification of the responses, of the survey response, among different segments of staff, whether from a management perspective versus line employees versus bus versus rail versus folks who work in service and maintenance versus otherwise? That 79%, does it stratify differently if you're looking at different segments within the organization, and have you analyzed that yet?
Yeah, that's a great question. That is our next step. We have the data that we're going to be analyzing, represented, non-represented, bus, rail. So that is our next step in this process, is to look at the engagement levels, because you're right, 79% overall, but there's, I would guess, based on my experience, there's pockets where it's going to be lower, where there's going to need to be some focus. And we'll be working to identify those pockets. So that is our next step in this process.
And you have a wide range of stratification.
Yes, we have a lot of different demographics.
Women employees, male employees, ethnic tenure, all kinds of things.
Race, ethnic,
Okay.
We asked a lot of demographic questions to be able to make those segmentations, because we know how important they are in understanding the results.
Thank you.
Mr. Downs, and Ms. Hampshire-Cohen.
A comment, and I want to commend the general manager for the progress, thinking back 2 years or more about what the survey looked like. It wasn't just we had cylinders of excellence. We had some terrible internal morale problems. The change here is beyond, I think, at least my expectation about the impact that we could have with the staff. So I want to congratulate you. I know the work that went into getting these numbers. A suggestion that tracking over the years is a better way to show progress. We tend to forget where we have come from. And just as a way of recognizing progress, the report, if it would track the last couple of years where we've come from, helps us measure our progress better.
So I too want to commend the general manager. In fact, when I read the report, I got excited because I think that because I think it's an indication that we're now ready to really drive the transformation. And I'm pleased to know that we'll have the analysis that will allow us to look at functional units, because what it's going to allow us to do is to identify and help managers own the responsibility of employee engagement and the environment, not just delivering on the results, which just, you know, really drives the transformation. And it will also allow us to be more precise in developmental plans for our managers, and also an opportunity to get rid of the bad apples, because you do have bad apples who create a bad environment for employees. So the question I'd like to pose is, do we anticipate that the information we glean from this kind of analysis will roll into performance issues for managers and supervisors?
I'll answer it. Yes.
That's the right answer.
I'm glad to hear.
And then I guess the last thing is, and I know we just had a conversation about budget. Rich, do you feel confident that we have sufficient resources to then implement our findings that may emanate from further analysis?
I think it's too early for me to answer that question. As was mentioned before, we have to go through the in-depth analysis, understand what we have to do over what time frame, and then I can better answer that. question. I'd be.
I want to add my appreciation to what has been previously said about the improvements. But I also want to go back to the slide number 5, which is the safety slide with the pie charts on it. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the difference between the pie chart on the right and the one at the bottom. It shows that you've got 53% of employees observing a safety violation, but only 43% reporting it. That would suggest that about 10% of employees have observed a safety violation but not reporting it. Is that something we should be concerned about, or is that kind of a difference fairly typical for these kinds of studies? I don't know. Could those be things that were so trivial that people didn't even bother to mention it? Or is this something that we should continue to work on?
You know, I would say, and I don't have a lot of norms on the safety, to be honest with you, because we mostly do engagement, and we work with WMATA to incorporate the safety question. So I could look into that. I don't have really the answer, to be honest with you, in terms of how this number kind of would compare.
Let me give you my answer. Okay. Anytime somebody doesn't report a safety violation is a concern. And so that just says to me we continue to have to do what we've been doing, which is to emphasize to our staff, right, you know, at the front line, to local safety committees and everything else, they should report every one of them. Until we get that done, we will not be doing what we should be doing.
I'm pleased to hear you say that. Thank you.
Yeah. And I just
and the survey shows we are doing better than we
yes.
were 2 years
yep.
ago. But
that's
still
yes. progress, making progress, significant progress. Yeah. I just sure. want, can I just respond to the compliments? I just want to say thank you for acknowledging that we've made progress, but it's truly the effort of the entire team here to do that, not only the executive leadership team, but all down through the organization.
Chair.
I thank you for that last comment, because I wanted to note that part, because I thought first the initial survey was really a bold move, and it gave us a milestone, a benchmark for us to move, and this is really a really good response and a place that shows the progress that can be made additionally in reflecting where we are. I also would like to understand, we responded to how we would communicate this after you have completed your analysis. There is also this part of communication. I think the ability to communicate the results in a way that not only acknowledges the progress that we've made, but what the employees reflect as their understanding and their option. For example, I think reflect a very positive image of who our employees are as a result of the survey, and being able to make that as a larger part of communication. And we've done some campaigns in that manner to acknowledge that we have a great workplace, we have great employees, we're making progress on that, and it's a continuum of the work that we do, and I think that's part.
Yeah, as part of our trying to have all our employees understand this, and I got enough surveys going on here. I got to keep this right. But we certainly met with the union leadership ahead of this meeting to advise them of the outcome of this survey and the one that's being discussed this afternoon. And I believe, and I have to check with my staff whether it was attached to an employee message. If not, it will be. I can't remember.
Anything else in the way of comments or questions? Yes, Mr. Nicholson.
Just. Thank you. One other thought around the employee engagement survey, and I do think it's remarkable. I would ask the question or make the observation that to the extent that the workplace environment, the culture is improving, there's also a relationship between the improvement of and the rebuilding of the agency itself in terms of the pride, not only in where you work, but recognizing that the machine is a better machine, that we've invested a fortune in rebuilding infrastructure, in rebuilding technology and process, and the relationship between the quality of the thing that you work on and the thing that you do is direct. And I think we need to make sure we recognize that as a substantive contribution to how people feel about the place and the job that they do.
The employees recognize, though.
Oh, yeah, clearly. Yeah.
No other questions? accept a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Meeting is adjourned. I'll turn it over to Ms. Bowser on the Planning Committee. I think